together we don't stand. There is power in a union. Now the lessons of the past.
Welcome to Madison Labor Radio. Labor Radio is dedicated to bringing news, information, and cultural events focused on working people and the labor movement to the Madison area and surrounding communities. I'm William Rogerberg, a member of AFSCME 6000. Your support is necessary to make Labor Radio and all the great programming on WORT possible.
Hi, I'm Lois Keel. I'm a strong member of unions. I am not a member of a union. Today we get an update from the workers' fair at UW. Take a look at Tony Evers' veto on the relaxing of child labor laws, speak with Madison Teachers Incorporated about an upcoming action, discuss the recent Biden visit to Madison, and much more.
I realize brutality and unjust laws cannot defeat us.
Next, Greg Jaboski talks to the Madison Public Schools Teachers Union about a demonstration it is holding next week.
As the public schools budget discussions continue in Madison, public school teachers and staff are taking to the streets. This Monday, April 15th, there will be a rally, followed by a visit to a public meeting on school funding. Leland Pan, a school social worker at La Follette High and a member of Madison Teachers Incorporated, or MTI, the union representing Madison public school teachers and staff, spoke Wednesday to Labor Radio. Pan described the staffing shortages that he sees.
So Monday we are having a rally and attending the school board meeting where we're speaking up about our demands, focused a lot around staff allocation. You know, we want to see the schools that our students deserve, and that means having the staffing that we need to properly serve our students. We need class sizes to be at a place where teachers can, you know, get to know their kids and really support their kids' needs. We need adequate staffing of support staff, such as social workers like myself, school psychs, and counselors, meeting the mental health needs that students have. There's always been a mental health crisis in education, but like especially post-pandemic, there's been a massive uptick in need around there. So we're really fighting for more resources for our students at the end of the day by fighting for more staff allocation.
Pan described how he sees a cost of living adjustment as necessary.
We're also going to be fighting for a cost of living adjustment, right? Anything below inflation is essentially a pay cut from last year. It's already hard enough to retain and recruit people to education. So we really need that cost of living adjustment if we want to keep our staffing levels.
Pan is skeptical of school management's cries of poverty.
I mean, frankly, I think just every time you hear management say there's not enough money for this, I think that should be taken with a grain of salt. There is funding. We know that MMSD is a top-heavy district in terms of funding for administrators. Of course, recruited a new superintendent, which we're excited to collaborate with. But, you know, he's coming in with a salary that's already above what many larger cities in our area are paying their superintendents. And so we know that there is money for these various initiatives. So why wouldn't there be money for staff who work with the kids day to day?
Although Pan and other teachers and staff welcome a proposed referendum to bump school funding, Pan explains why he thinks the referendum itself is not enough.
I know that there's been discussion of a referendum coming up. And of course, it would be great to see some, you know, new projects that would help our students in said referendum and more. But certain things like cost of living need to be a baseline regardless of the referendum, because that'll help us determine for next year how many staff plan to stay, whether we can recruit more staff. Without the cost of living adjustment, I fear that staffing the schools, regardless of what happens with the referendum, is going to be very difficult.
Pan describes Monday's action and invites organized labor in the larger community to show up and speak out.
Bring yourselves, most importantly, to 5 p.m. at Doyle Administrative Building, which is 545 West Dayton Street. At 5 p.m., we'll have a rally. You'll hear from various MMSD staff who can speak more eloquently than me on the needs. We'll have teachers, we'll have support staff, we'll have a variety of perspectives. And then at 6 p.m., the board meeting starts, and we'll have speakers lined up to testify to the board themselves. So if you can stick around, be present, show the board that the community is listening. If you can't make it, you can always watch the board meeting online. They do see how many people are watching the board meeting. And if you are willing to even testify at the board meeting, definitely feel free to sign up to submit public comment.
That was Leland Pan of MTI. Madison Public School teachers and staff will be rallying this Monday, April 15th at 5 p.m. at the Doyle Administrative Building at 545 West Dayton Street, followed by attendance at a public meeting at 6 to demand necessary funding. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
The governor vetoed a bill that would have lifted child labor protections. Carol Weidel has the story.
Governor Tony Evers vetoed a bill that would roll back child protections in the workplace. Senate Bill 436 would have repealed the requirement that the prospective employment requires a written permit. This veto comes during a time of rising numbers of teenagers working in hazardous or illegal jobs. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, there was a rise of 105% from 2021 to 2023 in the number of children employed in violation of child labor laws. Evers pointed to the historically low unemployment rate of 2.5% a year ago and Wisconsin's high labor force participation rate that requires real solutions for employers seeking workers. In his veto message, Evers said, "Not once, but twice now, I've introduced a comprehensive workforce plan that would invest in child care statewide to prevent the industry's looming collapse, expand family leave to help us compete with our neighboring states, invest in our higher education institutions, and bolster high-demand industries. Unfortunately, Republicans have rejected my plan both times." During his 2024 State of the State address, Governor Evers declared 2024 the year of the worker in Wisconsin and announced new efforts to build a workforce prepared to meet the needs of a 21st century economy. These efforts include launching the state's first teacher apprentice pilot program. Other efforts focus on the healthcare workforce and the state workforce issues of recruiting and retaining workers. Finally, Evers said, "I'm vetoing this bill in its entirety because I object to eliminating a process that ensures our kids are protected from employers that may exploit youth and inexperience or subject children to hazardous or illegal working conditions." Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Carol Weidel.
President Biden visited the campus of Madison College this week to unveil a new program. Labor Radio spoke to Evelyn Schmidt, a University of Wisconsin-Whitewater student and the communications director for College Democrats of Wisconsin.
Biden was here on Monday to announce a new student debt forgiveness plan. What can you tell us about that plan?
I was actually there to hear the president speak, and I can tell you it's a lot bigger than his last announcement. He's adding so much more relief for American families.
How's it going to impact you?
Personally, I'm very lucky that I don't have student loans, but the cost of college was something I heavily considered before attending a four-year university. I can tell you that we have many College Dems members around the state that are impacted by this loan forgiveness program.
Who does this plan help?
I think it helps middle-class families. Right now, our state legislators not funding these schools with public funding. That means tuition has to go up, and we're seeing tuition go up in UW system schools, and that's something that middle-class families right now and definitely first-gen students can't afford. They have to take out student loans.
What would you say to people who paid off their own student debt?
I would say I'm very happy for them that they got to do that and that that was something that they were financially able to do. I think that this is something that is a net benefit. To have a college-educated country promotes our economy. It sets people up for success. It sets people up to build a family. And I do think higher ed is something we should be investing in.
Some people would say that asking taxpayers to subsidize student loans is a backward way of making education just affordable.
For me, my family came here not knowing how to read and write. They started working and they made it better for the next generation. We want it better for the next generation. We want to make sure that we're putting in the work now so that future generations have an easier time.
How does student loan forgiveness like this help working people?
If you're not worried about finances while you're working, you're more productive, you're able to have a happier life. A lot of people can't afford to start a family. The costs are so extreme that it really doesn't just affect the poorest Americans. It affects every working class person, and it affects their families and their futures.
What do you think could be done to make college, especially public college, more affordable?
the biggest thing right now is we're sitting on the surplus in our state, and the UW system is not being funded because of the GOP-controlled state legislature. They've been decreasing the funding over time, and you can see that at our UW system schools. You can see that with staff getting laid off at UW Oshkosh. You can see that with some of our satellite campuses closing down. I think the biggest thing that could help students and help the cost is if our state legislature valued public education. I would say that the biggest thing that we're advocating for at College Democrats is for the state legislature to reevaluate its priorities and use the money that they're sitting on to help out students.
Is this a long-term solution to repeatedly forgive student debts?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's a crisis in our country of students taking on this debt. If we could fund these long-term and have more long-term plans set up, this wouldn't be needed.
That was Evelyn Schmidt. This is Janine Ramsey reporting for Madison Labor Radio.
President Biden's Monday visit to Madison was also met by protests of U.S. Gaza policy, Greg Jaboski reported.
While President Joe Biden addressed economic initiatives at Madison Area Technical College on Monday, he was met with a crowd of about 75 protesters filling the corner of Anderson and Wright Streets and demanding that his administration end its continuing support of the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip. One of the protesters, Kareem, is a University of Wisconsin-Madison student and a member of Students for Justice in Palestine and also a member of Anti-Colonial Scientists. A few years ago, Kareem was an organizer with the Anti-Sweatshop Student Labor Action Committee, or SLAC. Kareem, a Palestinian-American, explains why he and many others can no longer support the Democrats, the presumed favorite of organized labor.
We're here today protesting outside of Madison College to send a message to Genocide Joe that he is dooming his chances for the election and express our extreme discontent with his unwavering support for the Zionist colonization project in occupied Palestine and for the genocide that he's funding. So we're trying to tell him that if he's intent on writing blank checks to Bibi and the other war criminals of occupying Palestine right now, then he is essentially sacrificing his election chances in November. He's sacrificing the presidency, the Democratic Party. He's sacrificing the image of the United States as a country on the international stage, because he would rather ethnically cleanse Palestinians and he'd rather commit genocide and kill tens of thousands of Palestinian children by sending more money and weapons to the Zionist colonial state.
That was Kareem, a member of Students for Justice in Palestine and a one-time student labor organizer, explaining why he was protesting Joe Biden's visit to Madison on Monday. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
The inflatable rat on University Avenue is gone, but what about the contractor? Frank Emspach has the story.
On February 7th, the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 139, began picketing the job site at 415 North Lake Street. They brought along a huge inflatable rat to symbolize the substandard wages paid by the Brandt Company, the firm hired to do the demolition work. Earlier this week, Labor Radio spoke with Mike Irvin, the organizing director of Local 139, and asked him to describe the outcome of that picket.
Today is day 62. They're obviously no longer in Madison, but they are currently in Milwaukee at the Boston Store Northridge site. And we've been here probably about 2 weeks.
So you're basically continuing to follow up on them wherever they are in the state.
Yes, sir.
What can the operating engineers do to ensure that the city or publicly funded entities hire contractors that pay union scale and don't undercut area standards?
Well, the operating engineers are making a valiant effort to make sure that we educate people on, you know, it's not always about the lowest bidder, but it's about the lowest responsible bidder. And those two things should go together, but sometimes get missed. And that's kind of where we're at with Brandt, you know, trying to educate the municipalities, entities alike, that even though they're the lowest bidder, they may not be a responsible bidder.
Organizing Director Irvin noted that there are open health and safety violations associated with this contractor as an example of a bidder not being a responsible bidder. In addition, the leadership of IUOE met with Milwaukee's planning commissioner and expressed the union's concerns. The Davis-Bacon Act and prevailing wage legislation was designed to prevent the use of public monies to undercut standards. We ask if the laws applied in this case.
No, the Rescue Plan Act money on this job, but that Rescue Plan money doesn't tie into the federal Davis-Bacon, unfortunately. We were hoping it did. We did our homework and investigated that, but there is no ties between those two.
How does the International Union of Operating Engineers go about recruiting either members or firms?
I'm our organizing director. We have five organizers that work with myself, and we cover the whole state, and we go, our jobs are to go on non-union sites to talk about the benefits of being union and why it's such a better way of life. And that's, you know, what a union's job is to do, is to better their living and way of life.
The operating engineers also have an aggressive outreach program aimed at young people while still in high school.
We're in the schools all the time. Actually, next week, we got three different career fairs that we got in the Milwaukee Racine area. And we're also doing our 3-day Coloma externship at our training center, where we'll probably get in those 3 days well over 1,000 students to come through from around the state. And what we're doing is we're showing them what it would be like to be an operating engineer.
In addition to outreach in the schools, the IUOE invites those out of high school to join its apprentice program, noting that all one needs is a driver's license and a high school degree or its equivalent. We thank Mike Irvin for his comments. Labor Radio will discuss union apprenticeship programs in depth on a future broadcast. I am Frank Emspach for Madison Labor Radio.
As it turns out, you can focus on two things at once, if you're the United Auto Workers, that is. While the union makes ambitious moves to organized auto workers from Tennessee to California, they're also turning to other sectors to expand their membership. Labor Radio has that report.
North, south, east, and west, in every corner of the country, the United Auto Workers are organizing new membership. And while much attention is being paid to their campaign to organize over a dozen non-union auto manufacturers in the Sun Belt, the UAW has also been making gains among another major membership group, academic workers. The most recent addition to the union's academic wing takes the form of nearly 6,000 non-tenure track faculty at Harvard University, who voted to affiliate with the union on April 3rd and 4th. Through 2 days of rain, workers voted 93% in favor of joining. Unionization among postdoctoral and non-tenure track faculty has mirrored the UAW's increasing representation amongst higher education workers in the 21st century, and especially the exploding membership of recent years, owing partially to a 2016 NLRB decision that reclassified graduate students at private universities as employees. Today, the union represents over 100,000 undergraduate, graduate, and postgraduate workers, nearly one quarter of the union's active membership. This month's outcome, Harvard faculty say, is the result of a 6-year effort. For many, including lecturer Anna Isabel Kielsen, it was the only choice to keep up with the mounting costs of living near the university. Quote, daycare is 85% of my take-home salary, and the subsidy Harvard provides covers just 1 month of tuition, she said in a testimonial. Quote, Harvard says it values education, but it doesn't value its educators, end quote. Cambridge is just one node in the expanding network of faculty unions affiliating with the UAW. Across the Northeast, the UAW has been making steady inroads with non-tenure track positions this year. At Wellesley College in eastern Massachusetts, for example, an election at the end of January created a bargaining unit of just over 100. In February, over 500 postdoctoral workers at New York University voted for their own UAW local. Non-tenure track staff at Princeton have an election to join the union set for early May, which would add a further 1,000 postdoctoral faculty if it passes. Among the elections that have already taken place this year, the results have been decisive. Over 90% of faculty who cast a ballot in their respective elections did so in favor of a union. And while the lion's share of new additions this year are non-tenure track faculty positions, other university employees are still agitating for affiliation with the union as well. About 400 of Harvard's undergraduate employees voted to affiliate with the UAW in October, and a further 300 of Harvard's student residential advisors have announced their intention to join the pre-existing Harvard Graduate Student Union in an election that is scheduled to start next week. Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Sean Hagerup.
The University of Wisconsin holds a lot of job fairs, but it held one with a difference this week. Greg Jaboski reports.
On Wednesday, a third-floor room at Union South on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus was buzzing with attendees of the Workers' Fair, part of Labor Spring 2024, co-sponsored by the Havens Wright Center for Social Justice, the High Road Strategy Center, and the South Central Federation of Labor, or SCUFL. Stephen Goodhart, a political science undergraduate at UW-Madison, was one of the organizers of the Workers' Fair.
I'm an organizer for the event. I really believe that workers shouldn't be abused at work, and I think we're kind of fostering that kind of community and that kind of ideology here at the event, and just making sure that everyone is advocated while they're working.
Adrian Padgick is the managing director of the Havens Wright Center for Social Justice in the Department of Sociology at UW-Madison, one of the sponsors of the Workers' Fair. Padgick is also a member of the United Faculty and Academic Staff, or UFAS, at UW-Madison. Padgick described Labor Spring.
This is the second year that we have participated in something called Labor Spring, which is a broad umbrella of events that has actually been organized by the Kalmanovitz Initiative at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. They want to bring labor issues to the forefront, specifically for undergraduate students and campuses, but also into the deeper community to shine a light on all of the labor activity that is happening across the country, not only at universities, but also in workplaces.
Padgick described the ongoing Workers' Fair and what she felt makes it special.
What's really exciting about today is that we've gathered a whole host of workers from a variety of workplaces and work sites, both public and private sector, to speak to students and anyone else who might be attending from the public about what work is actually like so that they have a sense of what it is before, you know, you go for an interview or even after you get the interview and you get the job. You have a better understanding about what the job actually is versus what the boss might tell you the job is. And so I think that that's really useful. The bosses are very interested in recruiting the best workers, but we want workers to also be able to, in a sense, recruit their boss, like to be able to say, no, I actually am going in with my eyes open about what this job is. And if I find out that the job is actually not what I thought when I get there, what can I do to make it better?
Amihan Huseman, talking to visitors about social work and working in the university environment. Huseman works as student services at UW and has been a member of UFAS for 14 years. She feels students need an alternative to the student academic job fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think this event is really important because if you go to a lot of the job fairs, I've talked to a lot of my students and they say that at the job fairs, like, all you do is you talk to somebody who has some flyers and they tell you, hey, check out our website. That's the job fair. So you don't get to talk to anyone who actually works at the place. You don't get any information about the jobs themselves. So that's why I thought it was important to come here because, you know, my students are telling me this about their experiences at job fairs and everybody's encouraging them to go to job fairs, but what do they get out of it?
Not all the tables represented typical post-college jobs. Pablo Baxter, an organizer with IBW Local 159 in Madison, told visitors to the fair about the electrician's apprenticeship program.
A summary we like to say is earn as you learn. It's a five-year apprenticeship, but you're paid throughout the entire process, and your pay advances as you progress through the apprenticeship. It's a mixture of 8,000 hours on-the-job training and over 1,000 hours in-class training, studying to get you to be a competent journey-level electrician. Most people that get into it stay with it, and it's their career, because once you finish your apprenticeship, total compensation, including health insurance and three retirement plans, you'll be making about $140,000 a year.
Wait, what was that last part?
You'll be making about $140,000 a year.
Izzy Bielik, an organizer for SCUFL and a member of the Directly Affiliated Labor Union, or DALU, representing SCUFL staff, was at a table to talk about organizing. And Bielik stressed that organizing is something that can be done by any worker at any job.
A huge part of what I'm talking about is how when I got out of college, I took a lot of jobs and felt like I always wanted more of a voice and I wanted my coworkers to have more of a voice. And even with jobs I really loved, I felt like there were improvements we could make to working conditions. And so I think a huge part of what I'm trying to talk to undergrads about is the reality of the labor market and how even if they get their dream job, there still might be things that they want to have a say and a voice in, and they might want to work with their coworkers to organize around it.
Stephen Goodhart felt the vibes of the fair.
I don't know, it's kind of a party in there. That's one thing that is kind of distinguishing us from a jobs fair. There's a little bit more of an energy of collaboration and really just kind of an energy of advocacy. That's really kind of the energy that I've got.
That was Stephen Goodhart, a UW undergraduate and one of the organizers of Wednesday's Workers' Fair at the UW-Madison campus. For Labor Radio, I'm Greg Jaboski.
Workers at CVS and Walgreens are organizing a national union to address their short staffing and increased workload. Kara Weidel has the story.
The Pharmacy Guild has made waves organizing the first ever U.S. union exclusively of pharmacy professionals. IAM Healthcare is a specialized department of healthcare professionals within the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers, or IAM. A highly respected union that is nearly 600,000 strong across the U.S. and Canada. IAM Healthcare represents more than 10,000 healthcare professionals, including pharmacists and pharmacy technicians at hospitals, nursing homes, VA health centers, and other healthcare facilities and programs. At the website pharmacyguild.org, there are many tools for prospective members, and here is one sample.
Between the long lines snaking around the vitamin aisle and the soaring price of drugs, picking up a prescription has become a sickening experience for many Americans. And believe it or not, it's even worse for pharmacists themselves. After a decade of turbulence, burnout has become such an epidemic among pharmacy workers that they're starting to unionize. When the Pharmacist Guild's website went live on November 8th, it crashed almost immediately under the weight of 30,000 union-seeking workers. The uprising began a month earlier in Kansas City, where retail pharmacy workers at stores like CVS and Walgreens walked off the job in protest.
It's not just specific to one area. This is a problem that's teetering on the verge of a public health crisis, and it emboldened a lot of technicians and pharmacists to follow suit.
Reporting for Labor Radio, this is Carol Weidel.
Thanks to editor Frank Emspeck, assistant Robin G., copy editor Simon Gordon, reporters Greg Jaboski, Carol Weidel, Sean Hagerup, Janine Ramsey, Bryant Novinska-Loyce, and damage control specialist Joanne Powers. Special thanks to Keith Steffen, our reader coordinator, engagement editor Alice Herman, and to all of our readers and the members of the IBEW Local 2304 WORT Staff Collective.
And I'm Lois Keel. We'd like to thank all of the generous contributors to Labor Radio and WORT. Please stay tuned for Blues Cruise with David Watts and Professor Bill Clark.